Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance you can sort online anytime.
Well, my first guest this morning was previously editor of the Sunday Tribune at a time when there were very few women editors in Ireland. Indeed, her first managerial role was at the tender age of 25. Since then, she's worked with iconic travel brand Lonely Planet and has just been appointed Ireland editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Noreen Hegarty, good morning.
Good morning, Miriam. I'm amused to hear you say well-known. I feel a bit like there was a journalist many years ago in the Sunday Press who left, and there was a big party for him in Mulligan's of Poolbeg Street, which was a real journalist pub. And about 3 weeks later, he arrived back in Mulligan's of Poolbeg Street, and Con Houlihan, the late Con Houlihan, lifted his head from his pint and he said, "There he is, forgotten but not gone." And I feel a bit like that at the moment.
It's exciting, though. Are you excited about it?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I'm very passionate about what I do, and, you know, sometimes I wish I wasn't as driven as I am. So I'm very, very delighted and really grateful to get this opportunity. I wanted to get back to sort of mainstream journalism or newspaper journalism as such, which is where I came from and what I love. I wasn't sure anybody wanted me to come back. So, you know, really pleased that that has worked out. So, yeah, it's great.
And before we go back into the origins of your career, it was a difficult year. It's been a difficult year, hasn't it?
It's been, I mean, I think for everybody, COVID has been, I think it's a trauma on our lives, and we'll all look back on this, you know, and we haven't even processed it yet, but it was, yeah. My dad died in December last year, and then my father-in-law died in May this year, and then my husband has been quite ill. So, you know, putting all those things in perspective, a job is great, and I love the fact that I get this opportunity, but, you know, they're the things that matter in life. And, you know, as I say, it was pretty dark. In fact, I wasn't even going to apply for the job, to be honest with you. I didn't see the job. It wasn't that I wasn't going to apply. I didn't see it. I was kind of really involved in hospitals at the time, and a really good friend of mine in Tullamore, Brian Jaffrey, and I'd started my career in the Tullamore Tribune many years ago, and we're still good friends, and he's very strategic in terms of media, and he sent me the job ad and he said, "You better apply." And I was kind of prevaricating, and then I went, "You know what, I'll apply, but I won't tell anyone, because if I fail, then it won't be really public." So that's what I did.
And with your dad and your father-in-law, so many people listening this morning, Noreen, will have had similar experience. It's difficult to lose people during that time.
Yeah, my dad was like, you know, came from a farm in West Clare, got a scholarship to university in the 1950s when, you know, not many people did, became a civil engineer and built a great career for himself and a great business. And, you know, he was, you know, the centre of our family. And when he was diagnosed with cancer, it was a really devastating blow. And he lasted a lot longer than anybody thought. But, it is awful, because, you know, anybody who's been in that situation, you're in and out of hospital all the time. It's not just a linear diagnosis. Well, maybe it is for some people, but it wasn't for us. And, you know, that was difficult. And I think the last few months of his life were particularly difficult in Vincent's. And then he moved to the hospice and we could see him a bit more then. But, you know, it was very artificial. It was, you know, and anybody who's been through it, you know, it was masks and it was limited periods. And, you know, it wasn't how you would want things to be. I mean, he had enormous dignity. But, it's difficult. And, you know, for all of us, I think this is the first time I've spoken about it and not cried. And I'm surprised at myself, because, a loss of a parent for anybody is a big deal. And then, unfortunately, Frank's dad, my father-in-law, he passed away in May, and he'd had a protracted battle with cancer. In fact, he'd been in Beaumont and got COVID in Beaumont and had months with no visitors as a result, because, obviously the precautions that are there. So I think for anybody going through that, it's just not easy.
And your Frank, your husband, he's now going through his own battle.
He is, yeah. He has been ill, and he had sepsis, and he was in hospital for quite a period of time. But he's great, and he will be good. And, you know, he has a cancer that's very treatable. So, you know, we're very fortunate in that regard. And, like, he's been my biggest supporter my entire career. He says himself he's been in the chorus line for 30 years, you know. So he's the one that, you know, I rely on hugely. And, you know, obviously, as I said, you know, fantastic to get an opportunity like this. But you put it into a perspective, your family, your kids, you know, your friends, the people that are around you are the important people in your life, and you want to make sure they're okay.
So where did it all start for you? I mean, when did you realise you wanted to become a journalist?
I think I always knew I wanted to become a journalist. My roots are very much in West Clare. My parents are both from West Clare. From a very young age, I remember my uncle, Martin Vaughan in Milltown Malbay, nurturing that in me. He was in the civil defence, and I thought what he did was really interesting and exciting. But I suppose the first time I really thought this is the only thing I want to do was the time of the Tita Herrema kidnap. And I was a child and we were going up and down. My grandparents were alive. We would go up and down regularly to West Clare and we were passing Monastrevin. There were no bypasses in those days. You were through the town. And there was a 3-week siege where Tita Herrema had been kidnapped by Marion Coyle and Eddie Gallagher. And he was being held in a house in St. Evans Park in Monastrevin. And there was no way my parents were stopping the car to look and see what was happening. And I couldn't believe we were in such proximity to something that was happening in real time. And I suppose it was that curiosity. And even though I was quite young at the time, I read everything about it. I wanted to know everything about it. It was slightly bizarre years later working with journalists who talked about when they covered it. And I'm thinking, I was in the back of the car wanting to be part of it. But yeah, I think, and then that just grew. I mean, as I learned more about it, you know, I certainly remember by the time I was a teenager having an argument at home saying, it's the only thing I want to do. And my parents were sensibly saying, but maybe you should just do an arts degree and you could teach or you could do something else. And I was really determined, and I look back on it now and I think, where did that that professional confidence come from? I don't know, because I didn't have anybody in the family, but I just couldn't imagine that you could do this for a living, get paid for it, and, you know, like be at the centre of revealing things or telling people about things. And, you know, I know it sounds a bit trite, but that noble aspiration is still at the centre of what I do. I do think journalism is really important, particularly now, because, you know, there are so many conspiracy theories and so much propaganda and there are so many lies out there, that good journalism that, you know, Declan Lynch put it really well in the Sunday Independent last weekend. He said it should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that. And I do believe that it is a force for good in society, and in democracy, it's vital to expose truth, to expose corruption, you know, to ensure that we know what's happening in the democracy that we live in. And I still believe very strongly in that.
Now, you mentioned Clare earlier, because although you're a Dubliner, it had a huge influence. It still has a huge influence in your life.
It does, really. I mean, our roots are there. My dad is from Lahinch. My mum is from Milltown Malbay, from a very big family. I think I have 42 first cousins on my mother's side, and a lot of them are still in West Clare. So, you know, it has been influential, and for my kids as well. But, you know, we spent our summers on the beaches in the White Strand or Spanish Point or Lahinch, like blue with the cold. My kids went in wetsuits and were surfing, you know, and they had a whole different experience. And now it's totally cool. And, you know, it's a really great, I mean, it always was a great part of the world. But it's a fantastic retreat for me now, and I love to go down there, and I love, you know, I love the music, I just love the culture, I love it in the winter, actually, if I'm honest, when there aren't that many tourists around, and, you know, the place is kind of bleak maybe and a little bit desolate, but I really enjoy that.
So did you study journalism? What was your route into journalism?
I did. At that time, there was an NIHE graduate course, or there was the College of Commerce in Rathmines. And I think if you went through a lot of the journalists that are well known in Ireland today, most of them will have come through that way. They had about, I think they had 25 places a year and about 2,500 applicants for those places. And it wasn't based on your academic results, thanks be to God. It was based on your interview. I mean, you had very basic academic requirement, unlike nowadays where you've got to have a zillion points to do journalism. And it was based on the interview, and it was only a 2-year course. It was a really practical vocational course. And at the end of it, you did an ANCO placement in those days before internships or anything like that. And I got mine in the Tullamore Tribune. And I remember being so disappointed, because if it was the West Coast, I felt I had an affinity or a connection there, whereas the Midlands, I knew nothing about it. But it turned out to be transformational and one of the best, you know, introductions to journalism. You covered the courts, you covered the councils, you met the people on the street that you were writing about. If you got it wrong, they told you immediately. And I had great training. There was an editor, Jeff Oakley, who died this year in his 90s. And Seamus Dooley, who people will know from the National Union of Journalists, was a journalist there. And then Mary Bracken was the woman who ran everything. She's now deceased, but they were fantastic and they gave me a great introduction. And Brian Jeffrey, that I mentioned earlier, and his family were really good to me. And it was the best life, far better social life than Dublin. And I still look back on it very warmly.
You weren't a reporter for too long, though, because incredibly, you went into management, I think you were just 25. How did that come about? And how tough was that at a time when there were very few women in such roles in Ireland?
Yeah, there weren't very many. I mean, there still aren't enough. You know, it isn't balanced yet. I was working in the Evening Herald, and our news editor was Martin Brennan, and Martin was a great guy who worked really hard and said to me, you should go for this. And I didn't think I'd get it, and I went for it. And actually, when I got it, to their credit, the two guys that had interviewed me responded really well when I told them I was 4 months pregnant, because that meant obviously I was going to go on maternity leave and you're going into a new role. But they were great, and I did the maternity leave and did a couple more after that, and it worked out well. It was a tough time, though. I mean, I look back on it now, and you'd use probably the 2021 term of toxic masculinity. I mean, there were great men, but there were very aggressive men as well. It was an aggressive environment, you know, and I think back to the news conferences we had, and the only women there with me at the time were Helen Rogers and Barbara Power. And, you know, you'd have a news conference and somebody would get it in the neck every day. And this was an era where editors behaved like Kelvin McKenzie of The Sun. And he notoriously, you know, basically had a scorched earth policy. You know, people were roared at, shouted at, and it was like that. And I feel guilty now when I think about it. We didn't rush to each other's defence. I mean, the men or the women. You just sat there and went, thank God, it's not me today. I'm not getting it in the neck. You know, and it was just that kind of really competitive environment. And it was, you know, you do it, but it was difficult. And now you'd have terms like anxiety or, you know, other things you'd put around it. And it wouldn't happen now. I mean, it just wouldn't happen now. But that was just the norm in those days.
And it's unnecessary. Like, in other words, you don't need to have that kind of atmosphere to produce a good newspaper.
I agree, but that wouldn't have been the view. I mean, I remember when I got that first promotion, and after about a week, I behaved like that for the first week because that was all I knew. I thought that was how you managed people, that you roared at them, you shouted at them. I had one news editor at one stage, not in the Independent, somewhere else. And, you know, if you did something good, he would ring you from across the newsroom and whisper down the phone that you did a good job. And if you did something bad, he would bellow at you so that everybody in the vicinity knew that you were in trouble. And I did that for the first week. And I remember being covered in psoriasis, being stressed out of my head, you know, going home and saying to Frank, I'm going to have to quit because I can't do this. This isn't going to work. And, you know, I remember him saying to me, well, either quit or find a better way, find a different way. And I think I did. You know, I then started to manage the way I felt I wanted to be managed, which was, you know, that I wanted to come in and do a good job. Who was going to help me to do a good job? And yes, you do have to have a spine of steel when you're in leadership roles. You do have to have difficult conversations. There's no doubt about that. But I think I tried to be in a situation where if I had those difficult conversations, that people came out of my office wanting to do better. Whereas sometimes I came out of editors' offices losing the will to live, you know, just thinking, I can't, I mean, this is useless, you know. And I think that nobody wants to feel like that. So I don't have painted that, you know, it was all roses with me. It wasn't. I mean, I'm sure loads of people that are listening today will go, oh, well, I can tell you stories about her. But I tried to be fair, I suppose. That's what I tried to be.
Did you get any good guidance as you went along? I mean, did you have people who mentored you?
Totally. I mean, I was really fortunate in that, I mean, the two greatest mentors I had in my career are both dead now, unfortunately. Sean McConnell in the Irish Times and Nuala Phelan. And Sean, who never kind of carried a leadership position himself, he wasn't in management, but he was a fantastic judge of character, a fantastic insight into people and why they would do things. And he was my sounding board. I could go to him and say anything. And I think everybody needs somebody in any managerial or leadership role that they can be totally honest with. And nearly as you're saying the words, you kind of know what the answer is, but you've somebody that you trust that can give you a perspective. And Nuala was really tough. I mean, fantastic role model, you know, brilliant journalist, way ahead of anything I will ever do. But she could be withering as well. I remember once coming off a radio show and saying to her, how do you think I did? And she said, you sounded like an excited 11-year-old. And I was. And I mean, I look back now and yeah, that passion is great, but I was also very impetuous. And I was, you know, there were loads of downsides to it as well. And I didn't do radio for about a decade after that because I felt like I sounded horrific. And when I next did it, I actually didn't recognise myself because women's voices deepen as they get older.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, who is that person? And, you know, but she was fabulous. I mean, she was absolutely fabulous. And there were great people along the way. I mean, when I went into the Tribune, Michael Roach was managing director of the Tribune, and he had been managing editor of the Independent, and we fought like cat and dog, and we continued to fight like cat and dog. And I remember he rang me and offered me the Tribune job, and he said, you know, I've always been a big admirer of yours. And there was stunned silence from me, and he said, are you there? And I said, yeah, but you always hid it really well. So but and we continued, and everything, you know, if I was at one place, he was 180 degrees away, but he backed me and he supported me. And you know, you need that kind of sense of somebody is behind you, somebody gets trying to do, even if they disagree with the detail of it.
So it was 2005, I think, that you became editor of the Tribune. What was it like to walk into that role? Like, is it daunting?
It is and it isn't. I mean, I never really had a big plan for my career. And I know there are people that would guffaw at that because they would view me as being very ambitious. I really didn't. I kind of went into it because I wanted to be a journalist. And I'm an okay journalist. I mean, I'm not a brilliant journalist. I think I'm a better editor than I am a journalist. And I wanted this. I mean, I wanted to do something the way I thought it could be done, and, you know, that things could be really good. And I remember going in and talking about a meritocracy and this journey that we were going on, and I wasn't getting much feedback from the team. But of course, I'd come from a very aggressive, you know, newspaper environment, really, you know, deadline oriented, tough environment. And I was coming into a Sunday newspaper, which was a completely different pace, a completely different way of doing things. And I had to learn how to do that, and, you know, how to contextualize news and how to ensure that we were reflecting the week that had passed, but also trying to set an agenda for the week that was coming. And I was really lucky. There was a really good team there, a bit like the Sunday Times now. There's a really good team in place. And then you try and enhance that, you build that. And, you know, some people are excited by that and they want to come with you, and some people aren't. And, you know, that's the way those things always work. But there were great people in the Tribune, and I think when the Tribune did close sort of 6 years later, it testament to how good the journalists were was that, you know, we were in the height of recession at that stage, and yet they all found jobs within a relatively short period of time. So that was very gratifying that, you know, kind of people recognised there was talent.
And I do want to talk about that when it closed, because it was devastating for so many people. But when you look back, you know, what do you view as your greatest successes? I mean, were there, for instance, particular stories you covered of which you were especially proud?
I mean, we did break a lot of stories. We ended up at one stage, led by Suzanne Breen, our Northern editor, having to fight a bid by the PSNI in Belfast to get us to reveal our sources. And this was in relation to the murders at the Mazarine Barracks, if you recall, back in the late 2000s. And Suzanne had been the person that the claim of responsibility was made to, and then there was this bit, and we were kind of on our knees, and nobody knew, but we'd no money at the time, but we had to fight this. We had, like, you know, if you're a journalist, the protection of your sources is hugely important, and your credibility is destroyed if you don't stand up for what you believe in. So we did, and luckily for us, we won that. So there are days like that that are really important. And, you know, we broke stories, and, you know, about expenses of the Count Corla at the time. You know, we were revealing the truth. You know, an unfortunate consequence is sometimes people lose their jobs or they resign or whatever else. For me, actually, I'm just purely on a personal level, like, you know, not professionally, there were great things and other people broke those stories. Purely on a personal level, it was when Mark Condren, photographer with The Independent, and I went to Uganda with Goal, and we went to essentially report on children who'd been orphaned by AIDS. So we went from Kampala to Masaka, about 4 hours away, and into like really rural area. And the poverty, you know, I had never seen, and I think I've travelled a fair bit, but I had never seen poverty at this scale before. And Goal were there to essentially build brick houses for these children who were being reared by older siblings. And in the brick houses, they provided them with a bed, a mosquito net, the latrine, which was outside, and all their cooking was done over an open fire outside. And the kids were malnourished. I mean, the kids were not the size of kids, our kids in Ireland, for the ages that they were at. And it was, I can only imagine it was what the famine must have been like. I mean, that's all, again, that's how impoverished this environment was. And I went in proudly. This kid, who was about 11, brought me in to show me his bed, his mosquito net, and on the wall he had a picture of Manchester United. And it just so happened at the time that my son in Dublin, in his very comfortable bedroom, who was also aged 11, had the exact same picture of Manchester United. So I wrote a piece essentially about people, because I think very often we think of third world, or we think of, you know, kind of that poverty, and it's nothing to do with us. But this was just people, because his mother had given birth to him the same time I'd given birth to my son, presumably with the same hopes, dreams, ambitions for her child. And she died of AIDS. And her child was in this environment where he'd actually never even seen a Manchester United match. He'd heard it on the radio, but he'd never seen them in the flesh, except that somebody had given him this poster from somewhere. And that piece generated quite a lot of interest. More importantly, it generated a 250,000 donation to Goal, which was hugely significant at the time. And, you know, that was just for me personally satisfying, you know, that there was a connection made, or that people saw some other side to that whole
situation. When you're an editor, Noreen, you know, in terms of towing the line, being it from owners of a newspaper or the legal department perhaps urging you not to cover a story because it's dodgy, how did you deal with those pressures, and how will you deal with those pressures?
It's a good question. Every story is different. I know that sounds like a bit of a smart answer, but every story is. Sometimes you have to make decisions that you don't run stories. I remember at one stage doing an investigation in the Sunday Tribune that we put a lot of effort into, and three journalists were involved, and we never ran it because we could never really substantiate it. Then other times you do run stories. We ran stories about Sean Quinn and his business practices back in 2007, and the onslaught was unbelievable. I mean, he took out advertisements in every other newspaper in Ireland, who all took his money, to basically denounce our story and say it was untrue. And obviously then things happened in relation to Quinn and insurance and everything else subsequently. But that was difficult, very difficult. Michael Clifford, Conor McMurrow and I were kind of in the eye of the storm on that, and we were being sued personally as well as the newspaper. So that's hard, because you're sort of thinking, could I lose my house over this? And potentially you could. It didn't happen like that, and you know, obviously, as I said, events overtook.
Still very stressful.
It can be very stressful, yes it can, but you know, that's what you do, that's your job, you know, that is part of it. I mean, there are no jobs at that level in journalism that aren't stressful. There are no jobs in leadership, to be honest with you, that aren't stressful at times. I mean, then there are also great days. I mean, I always remember a quote from Vinnie Doyle, the late editor of the Irish Independent, who really was supportive of me in an era that, you know, it was difficult. And Vinnie at one stage said that the best days in editing a newspaper are like sitting in a jacuzzi bubble bath and sipping champagne. It was a very 80s image. And then the worst days were, he said, essentially having your nether regions stabbed by broken glass. there are highs and there are lows, and it is a roller coaster, but you hope that you're doing something that is worthwhile and something that is provocative and interesting and makes a difference.
I mean, one of the biggest lows must have been when the Tribune eventually closed in 2011. I think you described it before as a scar that never heals. How bruising an experience was that?
It was horrible at the time, because we went into receivership first and then into liquidation. So it was like this, you know, I think Ernest Hemingway's quote of how do you go bankrupt, you know, very, very slowly and very, very quickly. And it was a bit like that. We never had any money. I mean, we were always, you know, the poor relation in a sense. But that made us more dogged. That gave us a spirit, I think, that we were up against everything. So then, for it to end, for to know that there was no other way out. I remember one day, we were desperate that somebody might buy us, that there might be some opportunity. I think I made 76 phone calls one day, you know, trying to see would anybody be interested. And, you know, we were in the recession at that point. Things were not good here, you know, and there was no hope for the paper. And it was a shame, you know, it really was a shame. But, you know, that's the way it goes. I often think subsequently, you know, we won loads of awards, but we just didn't generate enough revenue. And that was the bottom line.
So brutal. Now, you went from there into a senior digital role with the Independent Group. How challenging was that?
It was a really unhappy period in my life, if I'm honest. I think at the time, Gavin O'Reilly had announced me, because we were a publicly listed company, as, you know, driving transformation, digital change. And I got in and I realised actually nobody wanted to change at all from the very top down. They wanted everybody else to change, but they were OK. And I found that I was, you know, kind of banging my head against a brick wall. And it was still in an era. And it's an ongoing dilemma for newspaper groups, you know, that the revenue is mainly coming from print. You know, it's a very simple model. Advertisers buy advertising, you sell the newspaper, and digital is a whole different scenario. I mean, it's a very different proposition. So, you know, it was difficult, and it continues to be difficult for a lot of newspaper groups. The future is digital, but it's not yet generating the revenue. So you've got to essentially, you know, make sure that you're still servicing your print readers as well as your digital subscribers.
Then you diversified, though. Tell me about Lonely Planet. And you left Dublin for London. How did that come about?
Probably because I couldn't get a job in Ireland. And, you know, they say the two careers that end in failure are football managers and newspaper editors. And, you know, nobody really wanted to hire me. Although Vincent Brown, in fairness to him, did offer me a job. But at the time, it was about a quarter of what I had been earning before. And I wasn't trying to be arrogant, but I just couldn't even pay the bills. And my good friend Sean McConnell died suddenly. And that really kind of made me sit up and go, you know what, you've only got one go at this and you better make it work. So I started looking further afield, and I started talking to the Lonely Planet people in London, and they got, and I think I'm very instinctive in the decisions I make, sometimes too fast, but, you know, in this case, they got me from the get-go and I got them, and I really liked them and I really liked what they were trying to do. And I moved to London, and for about a year I commuted. I came home at the weekends and worked there during the week.
And you'd imagine you'd have to travel a lot. Did you have to travel a lot with that job in Lonely Planet?
Probably less for leisure, because I've always kind of tried to travel a lot for leisure. But I was travelling a lot to London and then subsequently to the United States. I mean, in 2019, I did 58 flights. And that was, you know, 9 times to the United States, a lot to the UK, and then obviously to some conferences and things like that. So, yes, I did travel a lot, but not necessarily in the way you think. I wasn't the one going to the Seychelles and doing a review of what I found there. But we had teams all around the world that were doing that, and I was managing the people who were managing those teams.
And now your new job, which is huge, editing the Sunday Times and the Times here. What do you look on as probably knowing the greatest challenges that are going to face you there over the next couple couple of years.
I think in media, the greatest challenge now is people's attention. And it's not just, you know, in the old days, it was very straightforward competition between other titles and getting stories. And, you know, you wonder nowadays, do exclusives matter? I think they probably do. I mean, you look at Mark Tye's series on John Delaney and his book on champagne football. They matter. You know, these things do matter. But I think it's about attention. It's about, like, we are bombarded from morning until night. Everybody's producing content, from avocados from Mexico to Red Bull, you know, to Ancestry.com, to Netflix, to, you know, there's so much out there. And particularly in a digital era, how do you make yourself count? How do you become one of those go-to apps that people have on their phone? Because there's only a certain number that we're all going to absorb. We're not going to have an endless amount. And in fact, if anything, people are deleting things now as opposed to adding things on because it's just too much. So I think that to me is the greatest challenge, to produce content, which, you know, some people don't like that word, but it is content. It's all content now. But to produce stories, essentially, that are relevant, that are current, that are interesting, and that offer something that is different to what else is there, or a different perspective on things. And I think it's not just about those exclusives. It's also about contextualising, you know, what's happening in the world and putting a perspective on it and an explanation for it. I think in Sunday journalism, you have a great opportunity to do that because people tend to have a little more time on the weekends. But I think the daily demand is also important, and to ensure that the Times Ireland is relevant on a daily basis for our users, our subscribers.
Finally, Noreen, it must be nice to go full circle, because we started saying how much you always wanted to be a journalist, and now you're going right back in to edit, you know, one of our great papers. That is it exciting as well as daunting as we close?
Totally. I mean, it's always that thin line, isn't it, between being totally terrified by something and absolutely loving it and cannot believe that you're pinching yourself that you're there. And I think I heard Bono say one time that Gavin Friday told him, your greatest security is your insecurity. And, you know, I can be quite insecure, but I think that's what drives you forward. That's what makes you want to try harder and want to try and be the best and give it the best shot you have.
Anyway, Noreen Hegarty, congratulations on your new appointment. I wish you the very best of luck. Thanks for chatting to me this morning.
Thank you, Miriam.